The savage nations of the globe are the common enemies of civilized society, and we may inquire with anxious curiosity whether Europe is still threatened with a repetition of those calamities which formerly oppressed the arms and institutions of Rome. Perhaps the same reflections will illustrate the fall of that mighty empire and explain the probable causes of our actual security. The Romans were ignorant of the extent of their danger and the number of their enemies. Beyond the Rhine and Danube, the northern countries of Europe and Asia were filled with innumerable tribes of hunters and shepherds, poor, voracious, and turbulent, bold in arms, and impatient to ravish the fruits of industry. The barbarian world was agitated by the rapid impulse of war, and the peace of Gaul or Italy was shaken by the distant revolutions of China. The Huns, who fled before a victorious enemy, directed their march towards the west, and the torrent was swelled by the gradual accession of captives and allies. The flying tribes who yielded to the Huns assumed in their turn the spirit of conquest. The endless column of barbarians pressed on the Roman Empire with accumulated weight, and if the foremost were destroyed, the vacant space was instantly replenished by new assailants. Such formidable immigrations can no longer issue from the north, and the long repose which has been imputed to the decrease of population is the happy consequence of the progress of arts and agriculture. Instead of some rude villages thinly scattered among its woods and morasses, Germany now produces a list of 2,300 walled towns. The Christian kingdoms of Denmark, Sweden, and Poland have been successively established, and the Hanse merchants with the Teutonic Knights have extended their colonies along the coast of the Baltic as far as the Gulf of Finland. From the Gulf of Finland to the Eastern Ocean, Russia now assumes the form of a powerful and civilized empire. The plough, the loom, and the forge are introduced on the banks of the Volga, the Obi, and the Lena, and the fiercest of the Tatar hordes have been taught to tremble and obey. The Empire of Rome was firmly established by the singular and perfect coalition of its members, but this union was purchased by the loss of national freedom and military spirit, and the servile provinces, destitute of life and motion, expected their safety from the mercenary troops and governors who were directed by the orders of a distant court. The happiness of 100 millions depended on the personal merit of 1 or 2 men, perhaps children, whose minds were corrupted by education, luxury, and despotic power. Europe is now divided into 12 powerful, though unequal, kingdoms, 3 respectable commonwealths, and a variety of smaller, though independent, states. The chances of royal and ministerial talents are multiplied, at least with the number of its rulers, and a Julian or Semiramis may reign in the north, while Arcadius and Honorius again slumber on the thrones of the House of Bourbon. The abuses of tyranny are restrained by the mutual influence of fear and shame. Republics have acquired order and stability. Monarchies have imbibed the principles of freedom, or at least of moderation, and some sense of honor and justice is introduced into the most defective constitutions by the general manners of the times. In peace, the progress of knowledge and industry is accelerated by the emulation of so many active rivals. In war, the European forces are exercised by temperate and undecisive contests. If a savage conqueror should issue from the deserts of Tartary, he must repeatedly vanquish the robust peasants of Russia, the numerous armies of Germany, the gallant nobles of France, and the intrepid freemen of Britain, who perhaps might confederate for their common defense. Should the victorious barbarians carry slavery and desolation as far as the Atlantic Ocean, 10,000 vessels would transport beyond their pursuit the remains of civilized society, and Europe would revive and flourish in the American world, which is already filled with her colonies and institutions. Cold, poverty, and a life of danger and fatigue fortify the strength and courage of barbarians. In every age, they have oppressed the polite and peaceful nations of China, India, and Persia, who neglected and still neglect to counterbalance these natural powers by the resources of military art. The warlike states of antiquity, Greece, Macedonia, and Rome, educated a race of soldiers, exercised their bodies, disciplined their courage, multiplied their forces by regular evolutions, and converted the iron which they possessed into strong and serviceable weapons. But this superiority insensibly declined with their laws and manners, and the feeble policy of Constantine and his successors, armed and instructed for the ruin of the empire, the rude valor of the barbarian mercenaries. The military art has been changed by the invention of gunpowder, which enables man to command the two most powerful agents of nature, air and fire. Mathematics, chemistry, mechanics, architecture have been applied to the service of war, and the adverse parties oppose to each other the most elaborate modes of attack and of defense. Historians may indignantly observe that the preparations of a siege would found and maintain a flourishing colony, yet we can't be displeased that the subversion of a city should be a work of cost and difficulty, or that an industrious people should be protected by those arts which survive and supply the decay of military virtue. Cannon and fortifications now form an impregnable barrier against the Tartar horse, and Europe is secure from any future eruption of barbarians, since, before they can conquer, they must cease to be barbarous. Should these speculations be found doubtful or fallacious, there still remains a more humble source of comfort and hope. The discoveries of ancient and modern navigators and the domestic history or tradition of the most enlightened nations represent the human savage, naked both in mind and body, and destitute of laws, of arts, of ideas, and almost of language. From this abject condition, perhaps the primitive and universal state of man, he has gradually arisen to command the animals, to fertilize the earth, to traverse the ocean, and to measure the heavens. His progress in the improvement and exercise of his mental and corporeal faculties has been irregular and various, infinitely slow in the beginning, and increasing by degrees with redoubled velocity. Ages of laborious ascent have been followed by a moment of rapid downfall, and the several climates of the globe have felt the vicissitudes of light and darkness. Yet the experience of 4,000 years should enlarge our hopes and diminish our apprehensions. We can't determine to what height the human species may aspire in their advances towards perfection, but it may safely be presumed that no people, unless the face of nature is changed, will relapse into their original barbarism. Since the first discovery of the arts, war, commerce, and religious zeal have diffused among the savages of the Old and New World those inestimable gifts. They have been successively propagated. They can never be lost. We may therefore acquiesce in the pleasing conclusion that every age of the world has increased and still increases the real wealth, the happiness, the knowledge, and perhaps the virtue of the human race. 12. One of the most interesting aspects of this story of Europe in the 17th and early 18th century during the phase of the grand and parliamentary monarchies is the comparative quiescence of the peasants and workers. The insurrectionary fires of the 14th and 15th and 16th century seem to have died down. The acute economic clashes of the earlier period had been mitigated by rough adjustments. The discovery of America had revolutionized and changed the scale of business and industry, had brought a vast volume of precious metal for money into Europe, had increased and varied employment.